about the Stanton file. As of now, and as of some time in the past, all I have read of what you sent me are the investigators' reports. I will now read the other things after going through the investigators' reports. In going through them this time, I will be marking them up, and I will include such things as, for example, the word later, to make a note of things that are not relevant now, but in my opinion will be later. There is a handwritten sheet that is headed what seems to be people or persons served with order not to talk. I have put question marks on my copy opposite the names of Knipe, Brewer, Kyles, Jesse and Julius, I'm sorry, Jesse somebody at St. Joseph's Hospital, Julius Graham, Burnell Finley, Charles Q. Stevens. And if the name at the very bottom has after it MD, meaning doctor, it's James Spencer, and I can't make out the last name, I would include that. And the point I have here is that those people served with the order not to talk, presumably by the prosecution, are all people who have potentially or totally exculpatory evidence. In one case of which you know, a case I have insisted that you leave out of the present papers because it is my work and I think it should be held for later, it is totally exculpatory evidence if it stands up, and I think it will stand up. Why anybody at the hospital should be ordered not to talk when there are existing rules in all hospitals covering the right to privacy of patients is a good question. Of course, the obvious reason for ordering Stevens not to talk is that he had lied and they knew he had lied. One of the things marked for later, I want to go into in a little bit of detail so you will know about it, even though you won't use it now. That is the fight that Charlie had with the woman Virginia, who apparently did die. There were at least two such cases, if I remember correctly, what I picked up in February of 71 when I was down there. And both happened when Stevens was in the more limited protective custody. I rather suspect that this, more than his drinking, was responsible for their putting him out of circulation, and that this is the real reason Stanton saw to it that when he represented Stevens, Stevens lost and remained in custody until he got the mercenary lawyers. For your information, Cornbread Carter's statement that Renfro Haid lies about the gun is quite true, because Renfro admitted it to me, and I don't want you people to be deceived by it. Renfro told me that he made the whole story up just to cross up the police. On the spelling of McGraw or McCraw, please note that in the February 3rd interview by King and Getz, it is given as McCraw with a C. Another note for the future, you told me that Bud thinks Getz will be helpful. I'm inclined to agree. I want you both to be aware of the fact that he may be forced to change this position after the petition and the addenda are filed, and that if he is to be talked to again, I really think it should be done prior to that. While I don't think either one of you or both of you together know enough about the fact of the case to do it, I also am not anxious to volunteer for it. As I go over these statements, I am becoming more and more aware of what gets filtered out of them. It just can't be innocent, Jim. And I think you should bear this in mind in connection with what I've said above. As I go over these, I become aware that charges of inadequacy, if not incompetence, can very easily be made against the present defense, almost as much as those of the past. Further bearing on the adequacy of the Stanton investigation and its diligence, and on the adequacy of our defense investigation, is the legal-sized sheaf of three sheets from the Stanton files, headed "Be sure to get," with names, addresses, and telephone numbers, etc., of prospective witnesses. Interestingly, the check marks with them, with one exception, coincide with statements, copies of which you provided me. There is a check mark after Stevens with a then current address, but there is no statement coinciding with Stevens' name, nor a report of the interview and the letter-sized interviews of which you gave me copies. Also interesting is the fact that only one member of the King Party, Kyles, is listed. Others are at least as important and should have been included in any defense investigation. I think that we should try and learn why some of those from whom there are no statements and who are not checkmarked, including members of the police department and sheriff's department, and one FBI agent in particular, Fitzpatrick, were not interviewed. Imagine that the defense didn't even interview the coroner. Though the memorandum to investigators begins by saying a written statement, preferably sworn to, should be taken, there are only five from whom any kind of a written statement is included in the list you gave me. I'm sorry, in the copies you gave me, three of them are listed here. This is neither signed nor initialed. It is done on the same size paper, in the same style, and with a typewriter similar to what is headed UW Stanton Jr. Notes. If it is a note to investigators by Stanton himself, then it shows that Stanton was in possession of totally exculpatory information and that he knew the only alleged eyewitness was so drunk he couldn't have seen anything. The question that presumably Stanton wanted asked of the witness Dolores Lee reflects an understanding of his knowledge that there was no evidence that could show where the shot came from that could be found from the corpse. It begins four lines up. Also, she is supposed to have seen Dr. Martin Luther King walk out on the balcony at the time he was shot. If she did, we would like a description of any movements of his body. Now note this carefully. That is, did he stand erect? Did he lean over? And if she knows, that is a valid, and if she does not know, that is a valid answer. One thing utterly missing from the investigative reports, once they found out that this woman was not on duty, is any effort to find out if someone else, if there was a mere mistake in identity, was such a witness. In fact, the very next page contains a clue of this sort, a question to be asked of Bailey: give us the present residence and working address of Keolar Shivers. It appears to be C. like in Charles, E-O-L-A-R. Describe, quotes, she was a maid at the Lorraine on April 4, and is reported to have been walking toward Dr. King with an armful of bed sheets at the time he was shot. Close quotes. There is no interview with anyone named Shivers or any maid of any kind. This memo concludes with this directive, quotes, in addition, things left out, the names of any other witnesses present at the time immediately before and immediately after the shooting and the location at the scene of any such witnesses. There are not fewer than six important ones not on the list of potential witnesses for the defense, not represented in any of the investigators' reports. What follows immediately is from what is headed Hugh W. Stanton Jr. notes Ray James Earl Ray. One of the potentially interesting things is under Olivia Hayes, and it says that a Kathleen Covelt, K-O-V-E-L-T, editor, St. Louis Sentinel, interviewed Hayes in depth. I should have been told about this before I went to St. Louis. I spoke to the publisher, a black man, but I had no knowledge of Covelt. Elmer C. Holder is listed as a photographer. Why would a photographer be a potential defense witness? That doesn't say anything at all about what he knew or could have known. Peggy Ann Hurley is what can be taken as an indication of the importance of the investigation never made of the location of Mustangs on South Main Street, whether or not both were Mustangs, and whether or not Ray's was in front of Jowers Grill. It is under Peggy Jane Hurley. But some of these people could testify that a white Mustang was parked on Main earlier in the afternoon, is the clause I have in mind. Interesting sidelight on the perspective of the defense against assuming these are Stanton's notes is on the second page under King, the discussion of the Reverend James Lawson as going to Prague, convicted of draft dodging in World War II, and has visited North Viet Cong along with Coretta King since we have been at war with them, the last part directly quoted. And the dependence upon Hayes and the number of people listed as not interviewed is rather impressive, if not incriminating. Assuming these are Stanton's notes, Stanton knew the exculpatory nature of the evidence of the white Mustang in front of Jowers. More on Gargis is what is contradictory to the investigators' reports, and quotes Gargis as having a very easy and pretty certain way of remembering the presence of the white Mustang at the time he went into Jowers. Quotes, because he had to sidestep in order to get between them, close quotes, meaning it and Jowers' Cadillac. And quotes, he also remembers that when he left at approximately 20 minutes to 6, that he did not have to sidestep and that the Mustang was not there. Chief of 13 legal size pages, not dated, not numbered, the first page headed Notes to File on James Earl Ray. Again, assuming this to be the defense investigation by Stanton, the way it was given to me, the indebtedness to Hayes is incredible and permeating. The very first sentence is, as a result of the investigation of Renfrew Hayes, and so forth. Followed, by the way, are quite good, because I was there, I confirmed them, and these men could not have seen the package being dropped unless they were looking specifically for it. If I don't agree with their description of, quotes, very important, close quotes, there are a number of things in this memorandum so labeled and not done. Interesting point, and I think an important one bearing on Stanton's culpability, in having anything to do with a copped or negotiated plea is the paragraph beginning note after Paul Gargis. According to all the information we have, this so-called white car directly in front of Jim's Cadillac was the white Mustang, which would indicate that the white Mustang had been moved at 15 minutes prior to 6. Dr. King was assassinated at 6:01. Now, let me add that 100% of the information the investigators did get completely corroborates this, and there is what they didn't get, which also corroborates. I don't know if it exists, but under Charlie Stevens, the last line is interesting. A follow-up of Charlie Stevens is in a court reporter statement at the penal farm. Close quotes. Now, unless this had to do with Stevens' effort to liberate himself, I can't think of any occasion for a court reporter being there. However, I think this is something we ought to have. Whether or not true, this lead is so easy to follow, I think it should be done. There is a note that Ernestine Cofield, given as assistant editor of the St. Louis Sentinel, had long interviews with all occupants of the rooming house on the following morning after the slaying, and at this time he was in the presence of Ernest Withers. The results of these interviews was printed in the next edition of the above-named paper, close quotes. The address of the St. Louis Sentinel is 3000 Easton Avenue, and the telephone is JE43800. Now, I don't know if this really happened, and Ernestine Cofield left St. Louis. I don't know if she's still in Baltimore or not. The last sheaf of legal-sized papers begins with the sentence, "The following information was taken from index cards shown to me by Renfro Hayes." What is particularly interesting to me is on the third page what is headed "Statement of Renfro Hayes." The second paragraph has to do with the purchase of the rifle. Interestingly enough, it shows, although quite inaccurate, it shows that he had as a source somebody who knew the truth. Now, it may be that he was just going on his recollection of what Haynes had told him, but the statement was made on January 31, 1969, when Haynes was no longer in the case. The third paragraph is particularly interesting because of what Hayes told me, how disgusted with himself he was in not having checked out the DeSoto Motel. He was there with me, and he was exceedingly reluctant to climb up, he was a little bit more agile than I, to where the registration cards were kept. This says that Ray spent the night of April 3rd at the Rebel Motel, quotes, "having spent the previous night in a motel in Mississippi just over the state line," close quotes. Now, that is exactly what Ray told me, what I checked out first with Hayes, and I don't know of any record of this having existed earlier, unless Jimmy told it to Haynes. Haynes, of course, could have told it to Hayes. Further, under ASLOC is something that is absolutely fascinating to me. Harvey ASLOC. He saw three men in apartment 5 between 3 and 4 p.m. on April 4, 1969 when he came home. He can identify James Sanders as one of the three and a blonde as the other. Close quotes. Now, I don't know of anybody who knows, but there were exactly three men in that apartment at that time, according to what Jimmy told me. Anschutz is one of a number of witnesses not interviewed in the investigators' reports but included in the notes as knowing that the shot came from the bushes, which I take to mean the parking lot, rather than the bathroom, and Andrews had his door open, waiting to get into the bathroom. Because of Hayes' obvious undependability, I stopped making notes of the leads that are here. Some of them are things I heard from him. Some of them are things I know from others. Some of them, without doubt, should have been followed in any viable defense effort. For example, long, long after Matt Herron had developed the information, Renfro Hayes has essentially the same information as Matt.